What about Governor Brown and what he just did in California?
Well, precisely because California is our biggest state and because California leads so often in terms of what happens in this country, what a brand new governor says, literally within days of taking office, about his financial and budget situation is important for the rest of the country and sets a tone and presents a model that other governors and indeed many other politicians at all levels, federal, state, local, are likely to follow, partly for their own reasons and partly because by his doing what he did, he makes it acceptable. He makes it legitimate. He gives it a certain okay status. And unfortunately, that makes it easier for others to follow suit.
So back up and tell us, what did he do?
Basically, what Governor Brown did is tell the people of California that because there's an economic crisis, which those people had very little to do with bringing about, and because the federal government borrowed trillions of dollars to bail out the biggest banks and corporations in America, who got us into this difficulty, it's now time to pay back the people that were borrowed from. It's time to pay huge interest costs for all those debts. And the question is, two questions, really. First, why did the state borrow money in the first place to do all these things? And why is it now the job of the mass of people to pay the costs of all that borrowing? So let me answer the first question first. Why did the states borrow? Why did the federal government borrow? Why is all the government borrowing all the time? And the answer is really quite simple. You could raise all the money that the government needed, federal and state, to get us out of this crisis by taxing corporations and the richest people in the United States. The numbers are crystal clear. They have the wealth, and I'm going to tell you in a minute how we know that they have the wealth, but they have the wealth, and they could have been taxed, and that could have paid for the cost of a crisis they mostly brought about. Instead, what the government did everywhere was not to tax them, leaving them with the money that they didn't have to pay in taxes, which the government then borrowed from them to raise the money to pay for all of this. Now, if you're a rich person or a corporation and you have to choose between being taxed to pay for an economic crisis or lending the government money to pay for it, that's not a hard choice. It won't take you terribly long. So the corporations and the rich folks lent the government the money that they used to bail out those among the corporations and the rich folks who had gotten themselves into a big pickle with this economic crisis. Now the government, and in this case in the person of Jerry Brown, once again here in California, comes to the mass of people and says, we've borrowed a ton of money to get us out of this crisis, which we're not even out of yet. But it means that we, as the government of California, and again the same thing being said by states and localities everywhere, we are now faced with enormous interest costs. We have to pay all of those corporations and rich people who lent us the money. And that means that a large part of our budget has to go to pay them off. That's money not available for the police or the fire or the school teachers or the social workers or the prison guards or anybody else who needs a check from the government to provide public services. So the only way we can continue the government services is to tax you all a lot more. So the first thing Governor Brown did was suggest that we will continue for the next 5 years the emergency taxes passed for the crisis in 2009. Whoa, a huge tax bill. But he was afraid to tax very much because, of course, the rich don't want it and the average people can't afford it. So the other thing he did was to propose massive cuts so that the government can take money that it would have used to provide services and make it available to pay the interest to the wealthy from whom they were borrowing to get us out of the crisis. And what did Brown propose? Biggest single cut? Medicaid. The poorest people's medical resource of last resort, the emergency room visit, all the other benefits, is going to be cut. And to make sure that we all understand, it wasn't just the poor who were cut. The second biggest cut is to the state educational system, community colleges, state colleges, and the university system. $1.4 billion, which is an enormous amount of cutting back. all the young people that are trying to make a life for themselves, all the people trying to get an education to improve with the work they can do, the income they can earn, are all going to be cut back. They're going to have fewer teachers, fewer classes, fewer support programs. And in the end, what this all amounts to, it's making your poor and middle-class people, the vast majority, pay the cost of bailing out of a crisis that they have already suffered from through unemployment and foreclosed homes, and that they had really very little to do with bringing about. It's a way of shifting the burden of the crisis on those who can least defend themselves from having to pay. And it's an injustice of enormous proportions.
California is a great example, but could you just tease out a little bit more how that affects the shrinking middle class? Because there's sort of still a myth, I think, very strong about the middle class and its aspirations, and education comes to mind when we talk about that. And just parse that out a little bit more. The middle class and this dual catch-22 of the taxes are being raised, but they're not going to the services they used to. They're going to service debt.
The American middle class was built up as an idea, even more than a reality, in the 100 years or so before the 1970s. It was an extraordinary time, as I've tried to stress in my presentations elsewhere, during which American capitalism, the capitalism in this country, was able to deliver to the working class a steadily rising standard of living by paying them steadily higher wages. It's an amazing record for 100 years, decade over decade, even through the Great Depression, when people's wages fell, but the prices of what they had to pay fell even more. So in a sense, they were able to hold on. You produced in America this notion of American exceptionalism, of a special thing going on here in the country, that God loves Americans and provides us with a rising standard of living. And the explanation for that is simple. We had a continuous labor shortage. We had a successful capitalism that never had enough people. Now, partly it was because we got rid of the people who we found here when we came as a nation, and partly we brought slave labor to the country. Those are important factors. But other than for those, we always had in this country capitalists, employers, doing very well, but running up against a problem of not enough workers. And when you're in that situation as a capitalist, as an employer, you really don't have much choice but to try to use a rising wage as a way to attract people. We knew that if we kept raising wages in this country, which capitalists did, it would be a beacon for people around the world. And we are a country of immigrants, in part because from all over the world, people heard about and decided to take the big step of coming to the United States to have a better life, to do better, to be able to afford an education for their children, a home for themselves, etc. And for 100 years, they were right. They made a big sacrifice, but they got what they came for better or worse. And so it supported that notion of our exceptionalism and of that God loves America and all the rest of it. To make a very long story short, by the 1970s, the situation had changed. The labor shortage was over. And the reasons are not hard to figure out. Number one, American corporations found a new technology that radically reduced the number of people they need. It's called the computer. Instead of having 50 people keeping record of how many Rice Krispies fly off the shelf in the supermarket, you have a little scanning device, as we all are familiar with now, and one person sitting in Omaha can watch a screen where he knows exactly how many Rice Krispies are moving off every supermarket shelf across the country. So thousands of people are gone because you don't need them to measure anything. We know instantaneously what we need. The second thing that happened in the 1970s was American corporations began to see more profits in producing outside the United States than here. They began that massive exodus to produce the automobiles abroad, to produce the televisions and the radios and the cameras and the appliances and the clothing. We all know that they all come from someplace else now. It used to be in the early years of the 70s and 80s that the jobs being moved out were manufacturing jobs. That's pretty much done. What we're moving now are the service sector jobs, the skilled jobs, the jobs people have to have a college education for, the doctors, the architects, the accountants, the draftspersons, all of those kinds of jobs are moving abroad. Well, if you replace workers with machines and if you move jobs to the other part of the country, you don't have a labor shortage. The other important thing that happened in the 1970s that changed everything was the women's liberation movement, the massive movement of millions of American women into the paid labor force. They did not want to have that option cut off, as it had been for so many women, by the culture we lived in, and they moved in looking for jobs. Well, this situation of jobs being cut back because of computerization and export of production and employment, and more people looking, particularly our women, produced a situation where the employer no longer had to raise the wage. It didn't have a labor shortage anymore, it had a labor excess. And so capitalists do what they always do in that circumstance. If they don't have to pay the higher wages, they don't. So for the last 30 years, American businesses have been living the life of Riley. They have rising productivity, the computer, better educated workers, workers who have to work harder and faster. So they get more and more per hour out of a worker, but they don't have to pay him anymore. So for 30 years, all the gains of productivity have accrued to the employer side. They've made out, literally, like bandits. And so the American middle class, already in the 70s, was discovering that its basis for a rising standard of living, for having the goal of having your children have a better job than you did because they had a better education than you did, etc., all of that is under attack. For 25 years, we postponed the inevitable. We sent more and more people out to work. We took more and more jobs. But most of all, we borrowed money like there's no tomorrow. You know, people forget, before the 1970s, only a tiny number of people had a credit card. There was a rich businessman on a Spence account. He or she had a credit card. Now, everybody has half a dozen credit cards or more. That is a way of bringing massive credit to the average person and loading them up with debt, which we've done. By the time the crisis hits, it really is the signal that the postponing of the reckoning can't be done anymore. We're working more. By the way, footnote, Americans work more paid hours of labor per year than any other working class on the face of the earth. We work more hours than the Japanese or the Germans or anybody else you think is a hard-working people. We're number one. And we have a level of debt we can't sustain. So we're done. The kind of economic system we've had, founded on a working class, a mass working class of rising consumption and rising purchases, and it's over. They can't borrow anymore. Nobody will lend to them. And they can't work any more hours. They're exhausted physically. Because the women went out who had held the family together, the stress level of our culture is unbearable. We have levels of spouse abuse, child abuse, elder abuse, drug abuse that are epidemics that are not happening in other parts of the world. Anything like that, they're happening here. That's not because we're peculiar. That's because we're under a level of pressure of this kind of explosive end of an era, end of the middle class well-being, and now it's upon us. And the irony is, a crisis like this has taken what was happening slowly and speeded it up, almost like taking a film and making it go too fast so the action is all jerky. So suddenly, the American middle class is suddenly getting the idea the party's over. And what Governor Brown did was simply let us know we're in for years and years of high taxes and declining government support. Now, if you remember that we have a 10% unemployment in this country, which prevents any wages from going up because that's an excess of people desperate for work, you now have, real simply put, an American working class that cannot look to rising wages anytime soon, cannot look to less pressure from the tax man, and is going to get lower and lower services. Any way you cut that, that's the end of the middle class existence. It's not possible anymore. And the young people that are looking for jobs these days, they know that. They can't afford the normal things they had come to expect. They can't replicate their parents' lifestyle. They just can't do it. And this is a sentiment on the mass of young people that is already building in the end of that whole American exceptional dream.
And then the sidebar that I was just wanting to add to that is 10% unemployment for the average person based on, you know, we're talking about for white people, 9 or 10%. Here in Oakland, black kids in East Oakland, 16%, 18%. So
even if you wanted to use it, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the Department of Labor, which is the most important agency in keeping records of all of this, they maintain a whole set of unemployment statistics. Most people don't know that. The 10% refers to the people looking for a full-time job, unable to find it. So that when you ask them, because that's how it's done, when you ask them, are you looking for work? Are you employed? No. Are you looking for work? They answer yes. Then they're considered unemployed. The Bureau of Labor Statistics also keeps another number, which most of us as economists use. It's called U-6. It's the sixth unemployment number. There's actually a dozen of them. What U-6 measures is the number of people who are adults looking for work and not finding it. It adds to that the number of people who are part-time but want a full-time job and can't find it. And to that, and the third group it adds are what are called marginalized or discouraged workers. They've given up looking. If you put those three together, the unemployment rate in the United States is 17.5%. In other words, more than one out of six Americans is in a severely impacted employment situation. And that means every family in America has a person like that who's either a brother or a cousin or a sister-in-law or something. And it also means that those people are beginning to become, as they use up the little savings they had, we don't save much in America, they're beginning to become more and more burdens on the rest of the family. So that unemployment touches everybody. It's the person who you invite over more often. It's the person who needs a help when the car breaks down. It's the person who cannot, and unless you're a monster, you know, you're going to help the people that need you. And you, and that's another pressure on the middle class lifestyle, as you know, you're being pecked at from all different sides, and it's the end. And I think in America, having had 100 years of building up expectations that we're all middle class and we're all going to live pretty well, it's going to be very tense in this country as we begin to see the events of the last few weeks, as a population with expectations is confronted with the impossibility of any more realization of those expectations. You're going to get a lot of very upset, angry, depressed people.
So it's not a very pretty picture. If you could be making policy, whether it's on the broad economic bailout level, tax structure, which is really just one little part, I wanted to put this discussion in, can you offer any solutions? I mean,
loads of solutions. Indeed, let me stress to you, the biggest disservice of the government and the politicians in this country is really not even the terrible things they're doing, such as those I've tried to outline here. But more even than that is the unspoken but endlessly repeated, that is unspoken in terms of what they're really doing, but endlessly reiterated, in other words, notion that there's no alternative, that there's nothing else that can be done, that we have to be reasonable, realistic, all of that. So let me try to attack that as directly as I can. First, the government spent trillions of dollars bailing out the biggest banks in the United States, those that were deemed too big to fail, although parenthetically, if you look at them, they are larger now than they were before, because one of the ways the government saved them was by forcing them to merge. Wells Fargo took over Wachovia. You know, Bank of America took over Merrill Lynch, and on and on and on. So we actually have banks that are now bigger and will be better positioned to make the claim they're too big to fail than they were in 2008 when that argument was made. We bailed out the banks. We bailed out General Motors. The government now owns the largest insurance company in the world called AIG. It is currently running the two largest mortgage producers, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. These are semi-governmental agencies. And the idea was, by bailing out all these huge corporations, that would kickstart the economy, get us going again. Well, kickstart is a new phrase for something that used to be called trickle-down economics. The old idea being, if you help those at the top, the goodness will trickle down to the rest of us. Right. It has a way of never quite making it very far down that ladder, so we're all waiting for the trickle. Meanwhile, we're getting very dry. It's so discredited a theory that it wasn't called that this time, but it's exactly what was meant by the concept of trickle-down. Here's an alternative. We could have spent $1 trillion, taken half of it to help banks once again function, and taken the other half and done what President Roosevelt did in the 1930s. He went on the radio in 1934 and he said to the American people, if the private sector either cannot or will not hire Americans who need work, then the federal government is going to do it. Between 1934 and 1941, Roosevelt, as president, hired 11 million Americans. In today's population, that's about 20 million, which would take care of our unemployment in this country. Why wasn't that done? If those people had been put to work, they would have produced goods and services. We've had now years of people unemployed who produce nothing. We've lost the output we could have had. Number two, they would have earned money and spent it giving other people jobs. Number three, they would have felt very differently about themselves. They would have had self-esteem. They would have had jobs. With their income from the government jobs, they could have maintained their mortgage payments, and we would not have had the meltdown of our housing sector that we're still living through. This would have been a way to help massive numbers of people, directly impact our communities. And the most obvious question is, given that there is a precedent in the United States, 75 years ago, another Democratic president did that under the similar circumstances, you have to explain to me how it's possible that a liberal Democratic president and a Democratic-controlled Congress on both houses not only didn't do it, but never debated a bill to do it, never entertained the proposition to weigh its costs and benefits, its weaknesses, its strengths, against a program that still hasn't solved the unemployment problem years after it became a 10% level of difficulty for us. So my first question, my first answer is, here's a policy, comes right out of American history, and there's no excuse in this country for not even debating the thing.
Is it too late for that?
Not at all. Could be done tomorrow, could be done the next day. And then the question arises in everyone's mind suddenly, well, how are you going to pay for this? But let us take a step back. In the last quarter of 2008 and into the first half of 2009, when the United States government threw over $1 trillion at the financial sector, nobody asked where the money was coming from. Nobody worried. Everyone said that is a matter of national urgency. Well, one out of six people unemployed isn't a matter of national urgency, doesn't deserve an urgent response, but let me humor those folks and answer the question where the money comes from. Over the last 30 years, every measure of the American economy shows one thing, that the gap between rich and poor has gotten much, much wider. About top 5% of the American income earners have done very well over the last 30 years. Their incomes and wealth have gone much higher than everybody else's. Okay, they've done well for 2 to 3 decades. Their speculations had a lot to do with bringing this crisis, and they are obviously the ones most able to pay, which is the principle of our federal income tax anyway. Then answer this question to me, you know, for me. Why, in a time of national economic emergency, do we not go to those who have done the best over the last 30 years, who have more to do with this crisis than anybody else in the population, who have already recovered because they have the stocks and bonds that have gone up in the market? Why don't we go to them to pay for something that everybody else will benefit from and that should have been done long ago? So that's where the money is. That's where it could be gotten from. And here's a way of spending it that would be a radically different program. And even if you do not agree with this alternative, the fact that we have a political system that doesn't even discuss it is the clue. There is a consensus to keep these kinds of solutions and the analysis that underlies them out of public discussion, out of the public agenda. That's why programs like this are so important to inject what should have been there anyway.
And as people are filling out and rushing to finish their income taxes, what should they be thinking about? What should they be doing?
Number one thing they should be thinking about is understanding that the current economic crisis is a social phenomena. It comes out of massive social changes like the end of a labor shortage and so on. You cannot solve a social problem with an individual solution. you working harder, you saving money, you figuring out how to escape this crisis isn't going to solve it. Let me explain what I mean. Over the last 6 months, several governments in Europe have tried to go the route of jacking up taxes and cutting government services. And there have been more general strikes in places like France, Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal, even in Ireland it's coming. And in other countries this is building too, than we've seen in half a century. There's more militancy, and the governments there cannot do what they do in this country. That's why the social services in all those countries are way ahead of what we have in this country and are not being cut back anything like what we're seeing here. They have a much lower level of austerity and a much bigger movement against it. We have much more austerity and less movement against it. How do you explain that? The answer is organization. In every European country, the trade unions are stronger than they are here. They have a socialist party, a communist party, a green party, and half a dozen other parties that are fixtures of the social situation. Millions of people belong. When an issue like austerity, like shifting the burden of a crisis on the mass of the people arises, you have organizations with offices and newspapers and radio stations mobilizing people. We don't have that in the United States. So we have to face the reality. We have allowed over the last half century all those institutions, because we had them, to disappear. Unless and until we rebuild those institutions, we are not going to solve our problem. It may be a long road ahead of us, but what's the option? If there aren't the reformations of organization, whatever the form they take, however people want to do it this time around, and each generation does it in its own way, but unless we build those organizations and whatever names we give them, organizations of the masses of people, we're not going to get out of this situation, and we're going to sit and watch the further erosion of our freedoms and of our economic well-being that's already underway. So my answer is, you have to form the kinds of social networks and organizations that Americans have found too hard to do for the last 50 years and have watched them disappear. You know, our trade unions at their height 50, 60 years ago, represented a third of our workers. Now they represent 8%. You know, we had powerful socialist and communist parties. We had them. Whatever you think of them, we had them. And they made a difference. And one of the reasons Roosevelt hired all those people was they were powerful socialist and communist parties and a powerful CIO mobilizing workers in those years. And he wasn't stupid. He understood you better do something or else those organizations, well, you need to have something to worry the politician, otherwise not going to do what it is we need.
So when you alluded to the global manifestation of the problem and the different solutions happening in different nation states around the world, is there also a global part of your kind of solution visioning?
Well, I think that absolutely. I think that part of what's going on in Europe and part of what I advocate whenever I speak in the United States is that we need even more fundamental changes. Here's our problem. We keep leaving the control of production, the literal enterprises in our country, in the hands of a peculiar group of people. Every corporation is run by a board of directors, 15 to 20 people that are selected by the major shareholders, another 15 or 20 people. So here we have a company, 5,000 workers. They come to work 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. They make none of the decisions about what to produce or how to produce or where to produce or what to do with the profits. They create the output. They make it all possible, and then they go home for a beer and a TV. Meanwhile, the decisions are made by people who do what? Whose interest is in maximizing profits. So if it's profitable to move production to China, they will. If it's profitable to use a technology that pollutes the air, they will. They've been doing it. You don't have to take my word for it. Just look. So the ultimate question for me, and that's true all over the world, is we have to get to the point where we no longer think it's inevitable that all the basic decisions about an economy are made by a tiny minority of people, the boards of directors and major shareholders. Those are not the majority. For those of us who take democracy seriously, what is this? This is an undemocratic economic system that is now delivering to the mass of people years of crisis and years of decline. If ever there was an argument to reorganize production, to finally bring democracy to the workplace so that all of us together decide what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits, now, as capitalism implodes around the world would be the time to make that case.